Hello, this is Mark Shenton for Theatre Voice. I'm joined by critics Kate Bassett, Jane Edwards and Heather Neal to discuss two new plays that have recently opened in London. At the National Theatre's Olivier Theatre, Quorum Boy is an adaptation by Helen Edmondson of Jamila Gavin's Whitbread Children's Book Award winner that was inspired by the true story of Thomas Quorum, a retired sea captain who established the first foundling hospital to look after abandoned babies in 1739. In the Dickensian-like narrative, it follows the story of two kids who end up at the hospital, one saved from a slave ship, the other the abandoned illegitimate son of the heir to an estate. Melly Still, a designer-turned-director, makes her Olivier directing debut to flood the stage with actors, musicians, and especially the music of Handel, who not only provides the score, but is also a character himself in the play. At the Royal Court, Irish playwright Tom Murphy, recently described by The Guardian as the nearest thing to genius that Ireland can boast of, has written a new play that observes its title character at three points across a quarter of a century, from 1980 onwards, in a play that takes place mostly inside her head. Juliet Stevenson plays the title role in Ian Rickson's production. On Quorum Boy, Heather, I think you are the only one of us who's read the book.
I have read the book, and when I started to read the script, I thought, oh, Jamila Gavin won't like this, it's changed quite a lot. But actually, I think in the end she did, because the book is over 300 pages long. It's Dickensian, it's got hundreds of characters in it. It takes quite a long time to read, and some of the characters, especially the young women, are maybe a little bit bland. So I think Helen Edmondson has done a very good job in focusing it and concentrating particularly on the two young boys whose experience she places side by side almost. Meshach, the poor, damaged boy who is the son of the villain, Otis, who goes around collecting babies but actually taking money and then abandoning them. And Alexander, the son of Lord Ashbrook, who has to abandon his musical career in order to be a member of the upper classes and to do his duty as a landowner. Well, that's the first half, but of course there is a natural interval in that the book, too, has a long gap of 9 years, and we go back to the grown-ups, the children who are now grown-ups, and the next generation. But I think Helen's done a very good job, but also, one has to say, the music makes a tremendous difference. Of course, that is the wonderful thing that theatre can give you that the book can't, unless you make a point of listening to CDs at the same time as reading the book.
Of course, Helen Edmondson is a veteran of adaptations for Shared Experience in particular, but she also did a version of War and Peace, so she's used to shrinking large books. Mm. What did you think of it as a theatrical adaptation, Jane?
I thought it was amazingly theatrical and a real triumph for Melly Still, who, as you say, is I think she's only done two productions previously. I think the really effective thing about this piece is the contrast between the purity of the music, which is beautifully sung both by the actors and by the choir, and then this really gruesome, corrupt story of baby skeletons, of child torture, of a hanging. So that, although I can imagine, I mean, they say it's for over 12s, I can imagine a lot of kids might be a bit sniffy about Handel's music and think this is going to be a worthy event. They certainly wouldn't find that to be so, because they might actually find it quite shocking and all the detail of an 18th century life, which really paid no attention to children. Children were just young adults and had no rights until they were grown-ups.
In fact, the National are billing it as one of their productions for young people along the lines of His Dark Materials, Peter Pan and The Wind in the Willows. But with those scenes you mentioned, infants being buried alive and their skeletons later exhumed, and also the public hanging, I mean, is it really suitable for children, Kate?
Well, I think it is for over 12s, isn't it? So I
wouldn't
say
that.
A small 5-year-old in. Yeah, it probably is for a mature 12. I think there's a huge range with children, probably, and you, as a parent, you probably get to know whether they're going to be scared or not. I was sort of scared. they use baby puppets, and some of them are really grim. There's one bit where actually someone's trying to sort of resuscitate a baby who's on the brink of death, and there's a sort of jelly-like little baby which they wobble with their hand, and it's really grim. And there's a sort of rather graphic hanging as well, which isn't as grim, but I think... I mean, I don't think it's terrifying. I mean, I've seen actually more scary things. I think it's quite grim, but I think they're quite clever about dealing with... there's also sort of hints of sexual abuse and child sex slavery, that they are quite clever at intimating without spelling out And also, I think, by the end, there's just this wonderful transcendence because of the music that is incredibly uplifting and very clever as well, because it's actually quite a clever antidote to Paul over in the Cottesloe, which is polemical for being anti-Christian. So it's actually rather sort of interesting to bring in this sort of transcendent messiah without actually making it directly Christian at the same time. It's actually a sort of celebration of motherhood in the end via the Madonna, really.
Sorry, I was just going to say it's like one of Shakespeare's reconciliations. I mean, anybody who's moved by The End of the Winter's Tale, I think would be bound to be moved by this, don't you?
I almost thought it was a bit sentimental that even the slave child gets taken into the family. I'm sure in a real 18th century household, he would be considered lucky to be given a servant's job. But I thought we really deserved that at the end, because we'd been through quite a lot with these people, and I was willing to forgive that. And I thought we did need that uplifting ending.
Including the Hallelujah chorus, Mega Mix finale, which is, I thought, you know, like Mamma Mia has a finale very similar, which sends you out on a buzz.
Yeah. Oh, you were swept along that last half an hour, I thought, the way that the story flowed. I think she was incredibly clever with the use of the revolve and the way that one scene kind of bled into the next, that I think, you know, directors who've done 10 productions at the Olivier haven't quite achieved that flow.
And she only used one or two sort of tricks. There was a bit of flying and there was a drowning scene, which was rather cleverly done, but mostly it was really, you know, poor theatre on a big scale, as it were.
Yes, but it was so precisely done, wasn't it? I mean, ropes for ships, so that's nothing new, but the way they absolutely dropped that great thump was quite exciting.
Yes, so and it's very good for children, young people, it's, over 12s. They don't like to be called children, but they do have to use their imagination, and both Jamila and Helen are very keen that that should be the case. This is not the same as sitting in front of your computer.
And an unfamiliar story to those of us who've not read the book. I mean, a lot of kids probably have. But I thought the impressive thing was many still marshalling those huge resources. I mean, huge cast, on-stage band, that huge theatre, as we say, not an experienced director on that scale. And one of Nick Heitner's avowed aims was always to get more public plays into the Olivier and get younger directors working on them. It was a big risk, wasn't it, to give her the job. But I gather she did an astounding Alice in Wonderland last year.
Yeah, she's done a couple of things at Bristol Old Vic, and the Alice was kind of extraordinary, because you think of all the other productions that you see and they're sort of bound to be pretty and sort of fantastical, but this was rather extraordinary because it was just a plywood set. It looked like someone had come in and hammered a few bits of wood together, and you're thinking, God, yeah, this is not exactly Wonderland. But that's what was so brilliant. And then there was sort of, you've got giant crayoned pictures flown in, and it was just very imaginative and playful.
Of course, she is a designer too, and she co-designed this with Ty Green. And of course, this is part of a trend, it seems, that directors, designers who are becoming directors. Bob Crowley's going to do Tarzan on Broadway next year. He's directing and designing, but he's not the only one. Les Brotherston has been directing recently as well.
Tom Cairns, of course, did. Yeah. Aristocrats. And you do have to keep on your toes with this. I did think there were, I mean, for instance, with the hanging, you had to really notice. I mean, I knew that the villain was going to survive. I don't think I would have noticed the sort of negotiations going on.
But you see, I think that's fine. If you don't notice, there's this brilliant twist, because you think that, because there is doubling in the play in terms of acting and characters swap and actors swap roles, if you don't know it's him, it's actually this brilliant twist where you think, oh, well, he's Paul Ritter, who is playing the fantastic villain. You think it's someone else, and then suddenly you realise, as the characters do, that this is the same guy. So yeah. I think, in a way, if you know the story, you can see the clues.
Perhaps we should mention that the boys are played by young women, which I think works terribly well.
One of whom is Anna Madeley, who also has the most extraordinary boy soprano voice.
Yes. Although I did think it was... I mean, I loved the scene when her voice broke and then the older person stepped forward. I didn't understand why he looked quite so much older. I do think that was rather a big leap. And also, I mean, there is a slight problem, I think, with the interval, that there is an 8-year gap. I mean, you get it with so many novels when you adapt them, don't you? But there is a big jump to be negotiated there, which I didn't think they quite managed.
I mean, I thought it was extraordinary that I mean, talking about, you know, The Winter's Tale and other classics, I mean, I cared intensely about the characters and was kind of on the edge of my seat, more than in King Lear, quite often. And so in a way, I'd kind of almost recommend it for adults. I mean, it's not one of those shows where you think, oh, I'll just take the kids. It really does span.
Yes.
And we mentioned Anna Madeley, but it's in a huge ensemble. I mean, there's a lot of people in the cast. Anybody else to say that caught your eye?
Well, I think Paul Ritter's very good as the villain, Otis.
And his sidekick, Mrs. Lynch.
Mrs. Lynch.
Yes. Kept this
illusion.
Really good.
Ruth Gemmell. She is a frightening character.
Yes. And what I quite liked was they didn't overact it. You know, there was no sort of villainous gnashing of teeth about those performances. It was very kind of cold. And actually, the housekeeper was the more frightening because she was just hard-nosed. You know, she'd had a tough time and she was angry. There was class anger in her. Yes. That wasn't overplayed. It was just that she was callous because she had to survive.
Yes, no danger of hissing or anything rude like that. They were really involved and too much for that kind of low-level response.
So certainly a good departure for the National to have taken on.
Yes, and it's good to see them doing things for teenagers, which they're going to do more next year at the Consulate.
His Dark Materials, of course, of the National sold out in advance. I noticed that on the opening night of Corran Boy, even that wasn't sold out. Do you think that this is going to run in the same way? Do you think it can come back? Heather?
I think it certainly deserves to. I'm not sure that it's planned. We have to remember that Philip Pullman had already sold very well to adults. His book was well known to the ticket buyers, which is important. It's books, rather. Whereas Corran Boy is a harder one to sell, I think. I hope that it does gather momentum.
But as a theatrical adaptation, Kate, which one did you prefer?
I actually preferred this one. I mean, I thought, just to put a slight cavil in, I mean, I think the book is quite small, and so there's a lot of plot, and it's quite compact, and there's a moment where you think this could actually turn into a sort of Lloyd Webber musical. It's becoming so kind of hyperactive. And sort of melodramatic in a 19th century
way. It may yet happen.
It may yet happen. Yes, it may yet happen. But actually, I thought it was more beautiful and more fluid than Dark Materials.
It didn't seem quite so rooted. I mean, in Dark Materials, you knew all the time you watched it, you were aware that you were watching an adaptation. Now, I didn't feel that watching this. It became a dramatic event in its own right, I think.
On to Alice Trilogy, the Tom Murphy play that has just opened at the Royal Court. Does this one work as a drama, or is it really just a series of interrelated monologues? Kate?
Ultimately, no, I don't think it does work brilliantly. I'm sort of intrigued to see a Tom Murphy play, because he's so revered in Ireland and is much talked about and rarely seen here. And so I was glad to see this, but at the same time, I was sort of disappointed in that there was a lot of Beckett in it, and there was a lot of the play Not I by Beckett. There were sort of too many echoes of it for me. I thought it was intriguing. I mean, basically what you have is you have glimpses of a woman at different points in her life. She's basically a sort of frustrated, unhappy housewife with a potential sort of dangerous Medea-like side regarding her children. There's this sort of slight tension about if she's ever going to do anything stupid.
And then she's only in her 20s in the first
season. She's only in her 20s, played by Juliet Stevenson, who kind of pulls it off, I think, actually. But she has a monologue in an attic with a sort of alter ego, and then she meets an ex-lover, and they toy with the idea of getting back together, and then she's later in an airport with her husband when their son has died. And you're never quite sure what's in her head. And so there's kind of nice teasing games with what kind of realm are we in? Are we in her imagination? Are we actually in an attic, actually in an airport? Is it her dream? Is it the old flame's dream? And I found all that quite interesting. And there's a sort of rather wonderful lyricism sometimes, which I think Stevenson is quite good at picking up, and Ian Rickson, the director, is very good at fine-tuning all those kind of rhythms. But it's quite verbose, and Unlike you were talking about the Corran Boy, I didn't really care about anyone. Perhaps I did very slightly at the end, but I was rather left cold.
Were you cold, Jane?
By the end, no. But it was quite a long way to go to get to the final scene, although I suppose that it did make you understand what had turned her into the woman she'd become, because she is a very embittered woman, and all the thoughts, we hear her thoughts while her husband sits opposite her chomping on these fish and chips, and they're waiting for this coffin of her son to be unloaded. So, you know, the worst thing that could ever happen has happened, Whereas in the past two scenes, you're kind of thinking to yourself, well, for God's sake, why don't you just leave your husband, you know? And she's feeling, you know, this great sense that, well, this is as bad as it can get, and actually life goes on, and almost that's the worst thing, that life does go on. And then this really improbable event happens, but it's like a catalyst for her to suddenly become aware of her sort of common humanity and sharing a feeling with something else, which provokes this sudden outpouring of feeling, which is rather remarkable. I mean, I think, because she's quite wobbly in her Irishness throughout the rest. I mean, I suppose they've surrounded her with very good Irish actors, and you might have thought she might have picked it up, but she hasn't really. But at that moment, it does become very bleak, a great sense of our isolation. I mean, very Beckettian, as Kate says, but it does have a power of its own at the end. But yeah, it's quite a long way to go.
And there's that wonderful moment with the waitress where she finally actually reaches out to somebody else.
Well, that's what I meant, yes.
I didn't really buy that last
Well, I didn't
bit.
Buy the event, but I bought what it provoked
what it meant.
In
yes,
her.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think, I presume that the important line earlier on is emotionality is supposedly a woman's prerogative and supposed to make them feel better. But although she seems to have an underlying sense of her own emotion, she's locked up. I presume that's why she goes to creative writing classes and tries to find some sort of outlet for it. Unfortunately, she uses what she learns there to send a letter to an old lover, which she apparently doesn't expect him to respond to. That was an exercise. And, oh, here he is. Well played by Stanley Townsend, I thought. I mean, I think he's a very good actor. But then we don't get her unlocking until the very last few minutes. And as you say, it seems an awful long wait, and I didn't find it very credible. And it took someone else to move towards her before this could happen. She never did manage to find her way into being a human being. And I mean, I just came away, you know, with the awful life lesson, you know, don't moan about things now, it could get even worse.
But what, there was a desperate sense, wasn't there, when these thoughts were going through her head and she was talking about the son's girlfriend, and she said, oh, well, I could have suggested that she might have liked one of his belongings. And you feel that she's got this sort of armour around her that she can no longer break through. I mean, I did find that quite sort of powerful and chilling.
Yes, actually, I thought that moment was very good, because it was all that sort of tension between she has a moment of sympathy that isn't egotistical, and yet at the same time she almost sort of goes, oh, well. And you're thinking, that girl has just lost.
Mm. But I think Juliet Stevenson should be commended for doing so well in such difficult circumstances.
Yeah, she's virtually on her own, isn't she? I mean, although she's surrounded by these brilliant actors. I mean, I thought the husband in the last scene, eating that meal, I mean, he's going to have to eat that meal every single night. That's quite a task. I was wondering, I was sitting there wondering, does he get to choose what he eats every night, and then does he go eat another?
It's airport food.
It's a real menu, and they have to be preparing everything next day. Remember
to change her lines, wouldn't you?
I was told by a stage manager on Feston that they did get the food in specially every night, and it was his job to do that.
I mean, I thought in a way the production was better than the play, you know, apart from Juliet Stevens' accent, which did wobble a bit. I mean, I thought the set, I mean, Ian Rickson, it's kind of nice to see him back directing, which he's done less than you'd think as artistic director of the Royal Court. And he is very good at doing sensitive and eerie and ghostly plays. He did The Weir. And those moments when those sort of ghostly figures step out of a black wall and you haven't even seen them, and suddenly you see these kind of characters emerging out of the brickwork, are fantastic. And I thought, actually, almost all the performances were excellent. I thought Stanley Townsend was really good. And that scene, even though it's sort of overlong and the play is in a way fragmented, there are these great tensions, and in him a kind of journey from seeming very benign and loving and kind of going back to that old flame status and being very fond and magnanimous towards her. And then this sort of edgy, creepy obsessiveness about him, and then turning really nasty at the end. So there is a kind of quite strong shape to that scene.
It's interesting, one of our colleagues, Michael Billington, actually cited that as his favourite scene in the play, and yet I think we're all agreed that the third scene is what does it for us, that makes it into a play.
I might go for Stanley Townsend scene, actually.
But the second scene is the only one which is really a play. I mean, there's interaction between people, whereas that doesn't happen in the other two scenes, does it?
So would we recommend the play, Jane?
If you're of a bleak, depressive disposition and
not for a Christmas
want to go
outing.
And sit in a theatre and experience that, yes, otherwise no.
Heather?
I think probably not, unless you want to, you know, be collecting your Tom Murphy.
Yes, I was going to say the same thing. I mean, in a way, if you've seen a few Tom Murphys, it's quite an interesting comparison. And if you're thinking about how he fits into the Irish tradition of Beckett onto Conor McPherson, he's kind of interesting. But it wouldn't be top 10 for me.
Thank you, Jane, Heather, and Kate.